One I read a while ago. I have it in the house. I've looked all over the house for it. Yesterday I couldn't find it. I know it's there somewhere. Stranger is Watching.
Oh, that was, yeah.
1978.
That's right.
I enjoyed reading that.
And, oh, thank you.
So I wanted to bring that in and ask you to sign it, but I couldn't find it. Sir, it's there somewhere, but I'm
overwhelmed. Well, you know, Frank Miller is a longtime friend. He's one of the vice presidents here.
I know Frank.
You know Frank? He's a lovely guy, and I have a place up at the Cape, too. So if you ever have it, just leave it with him, and I'll catch him at some point.
All right. I was disappointed with the movie version of that.
It's terrible.
Rip Torn. It didn't...
Yeah. I felt sorry for Rip Torn. He went in to make Wee Wee, and they mugged him. It was the most ridiculous. Remember when he goes into the men's room and six guys jump him?
Yeah, that didn't make sense.
And
also, there were other things wrong. As I recall, he was making a bomb, right?
Yeah.
And didn't they leave that out?
I don't think they did.
I don't think they put the bomb part
they
in.
They didn't, and they never explain why the caretaker of the house left the window open, and then he goes in and stabs him. They never explain that. I just thought it was lousy. And then she's swearing like a sailor, which immediately reduces any worry about the sweet young thing in danger. They take a 6-year-old and make him a 14-year-old teen, and Papa, gee, we've got to get out of here, you know?
The movie didn't... I made a point of watching the movie because I'd read the book, and I wanted to see how they handle it. There was another movie I was disappointed in. That was the... remember Lawrence Saunders' book, The First Deadly Sin?
Mm-hmm.
Did you read that by chance?
Yes, I did.
I thought that was
That book. I didn't see the movie, and everybody said it was such a disappointment.
They withdrew the movie after about a week. It had Frank Sinatra in it, and it had Faye Dunaway.
Good cast. Wonderful. But if you
ruined it.
No, as a matter of fact, I did see it, and it was lousy. They had juxtaposed her being operated on, and... Remember? Yeah, I did see it, but... It was an intense... The cop's wife, you know, the...
Oh, yeah.
Most of it
occurred on her deathbed.
That's what I mean.
The whole intent, and using all of these... they misplaced the intent of the movie because they... although we want to talk about your stuff, but just to mention this, as I recall, it's been some time since I had read the book, but the detective uses a whole bunch of average, everyday people... Because he's officially retired.
Yeah, right.
I don't think he was retired in the movie version, but he was officially retired.
Yeah.
And so he uses a whole bunch of people, neighborhood people, strange people. One was a cripple, I think. Somebody else was blind. He used a whole bunch of people to help him gather evidence.
Yeah.
And they missed all of that. It was absolutely horrible. They just ruined the movie.
Well, they ruined the tenderness of that movie. You know, that guy's deep concern, and then the business about his wife dying, and then the young woman whose husband was murdered a year later, the little epilogue they'd gotten together, which was kind of nice. They lost everything. Now, where are the children is being filmed in the Cape? It's wonderful.
Can I ask you about that? How far are they in filming that?
Well, they finished December 23rd. They started November 5th. Jill Clayburgh is fantastic. She is Nancy in that book. And they said that, I've been up a couple of times, I was an extra in it. I made $24.
Is that right?
Yes.
Think you'll see yourself?
Of course I'll see myself.
They cut out an awful lot, though. They over.
They won't cut this out, because this one scene is vital. She has just been convicted of the murder of her first children. It's a flashback that takes about 30 seconds, where she's coming out of the courtroom in handcuffs. But it's necessary for the film, fortunately. And the first cut I ruined, because they said, everybody, you're a news reporter, Mrs. Clark, you know all the other extras, and we're going to have you up in front so we can really see you. And you people lunge at her, shout questions at her, you're vultures. So I had been best actress in the Bronx, you see, so I worked my way up into this. And they said, okay, energy people, action. So I go racing at her, come on, Jill, come on, Jill, did you kill your kids, Jill? Cut, cut, who called her Jill? So I think that I'm not going to get a Hollywood contract. I'm going to have to stick to the word processor.
Where in the Cape are they filming the movie?
They're filming it in Provincetown. They're doing that next week. I was at the courthouse in Barnstable. They have a house in Katumet, which is perfect for the Eldridge home. And across the lake from it, they have a house that is the lookout. And it's there. Whoever did the scouting did a wonderful job. And Frederick Forrest is in it. He's the villain in it. And he's terrific.
Yeah, I just saw him in something recently.
Yeah, he's a fine actor.
But I can't think of what it was. Where is your house on the Cape?
In Tennis, mid-Cape.
I plan to go to Chatham this summer for a week. I usually go the my alma mater has a summer theater at Chatham called Monomoy.
Oh, sure, I know.
They operate every year, and so I usually try to go there for a few days.
Well, I just pull up the drawbridge in June, and I say, anyone wants me, come on up to the Cape. Because the house is year-round. It's wonderful. And I just leave it open so I can grab a quick weekend, or the kids do it as well. But it's right on the water in Dennis, just on a hill over the water. You go down 39 steps to the beach.
I like the Cape.
I love it.
I think it has much more character than Long Island.
Well, I just always knew I would like the Cape. When I was a kid and used to read in the women's magazines where the husbands took the train up, I thought it was so glamorous, and I thought, that's a place I'm going to like. And when I was writing radio shows, I did one about the fact that they were worried about the Cape, that it was getting too cluttered. And I thought, oh, no, don't get messed up before I get there. And then about 17 years ago, some friends were up and invited a gang of us from the office. And as soon as I got off the plane, I said, this is it. And I rented for 11 years, you know, places... the cheapest ones I could find.
On a summer basis.
One we call the slave quarters, another we call was the name of it was the sea shanty.
Mm-hmm.
But then, because of Where Are the Children, I was able to buy my own place up there.
I imagine property values in the Cape are very high.
Yeah, they're really going up, up, up. And of course, waterfront is heaven. I mean, waterfront is out of sight. To be on the bay, which is the ocean, of course, is terrific.
Had a disaster there. Although my visit to the Cape 2 years ago was nice, we went to Nantucket, where we'd been a number of times, but this visit turned out to be a disaster. One, I didn't like the... we were staying in an old house, which looked nice from the outside. I had checked it out earlier, but the room we had was just horrible.
Uh-huh.
And there was just a curtain that separated the sink from the rest of the room.
Oh, that's swell, yeah.
And
that's real
then there was a little tiny bathroom with a metal shower stall and a bare light bulb, and the landlord was extremely eccentric. He would, I would ask for ice. He'd bring the ice out in a little baggie.
Oh, my
enough for one martini, maybe. So I have to keep going back, and he would be annoyed, you know, if I asked for another baggie with the ice.
Oh, you spent a week there?
No, we left after about 2 days.
Oh, I would
think
so.
We were going to spend several days.
There are so many lovely places
factor that led to our decision to leave that time was that it began to rain.
Yeah.
And how many times can you see the Whaling Museum?
Oh, do you have kids with you?
I had one kid. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
a teenager who was also very annoying to have around. As teenagers being what they are, I think the highlight of that trip to Nantucket was watching the movie of The World According to Garp.
Oh, and you didn't have to go to Nantucket to see The World According to Garp.
No, I even have it on tape now. So. Well, we've been talking about the Cape and everything. Let's talk a little bit about you. I have a lot of biographical material in the profile that Simon Schuster sent over. But I would like to talk to you about how your first book came about. And I understand this was 1969 and was about George Washington,
read by the favored few. Published as a whispering campaign.
Is this a juvenile?
Well, it was published as both a young adult and adult book. But the thing was, the Meredith Press had just been sold, so they really didn't bother with any of the books. There was no publicity. There were no ads, not even something the size of an obituary notice. So the few bookstores that it sort of slithered into, it got placed next to the spiritual books because everyone glanced at Aspire to the Heavens and they thought it was kind of uplifting thoughts for the day. So it just never had a chance. I like the book. I really do. It was a nice book. We're down to 4 copies in the family. And it's a novelized biography told from his viewpoint about his life, set the day he leaves the presidency on his journey back to Mount Vernon. And then it's a series of flashbacks, you know, the journey from the early days in Mount Vernon. And I think it's a darn nice book. My agent asked me not to talk about it because it's out of print, and she gets about 50 letters a week asking where people can get it. And she said even if they could get it, nobody wants to read about George Washington. They're going to look for a mystery from
only them. The 50 people a week who write in for it.
Yeah, but they think it's another mystery. As a matter of fact, Betty Ford phoned, her secretary phoned Simon & Schuster a couple of years ago and said Mrs. Ford was a fan of mine and she'd like to get a spy to the heavens. So I said, well, you can't buy it anywhere. I will gladly give her one of my 4 copies if she wants to read about George Washington. I never heard another word.
Well, even though this was a biography, in effect, of George Washington, I assume the mystery genre was somehow lurking in the back of your mind.
Well, the thing is that that proved to me I could write a book, because I had been writing short stories and selling them, and then the short story market absolutely collapsed in the early 1960s.
What kind of short stories?
Well, I wrote for Family Circle. I was in Best Post Stories of 62, the Saturday Evening Post, McCall's Red Book.
What were the themes of the stories?
I started out doing stewardess background because I'd been a flight stewardess with Pan American. So I used that, where the stewardess was the heroine. And the funny part is the first two were suspense stories, only because I had an idea for a suspense. But I never thought of myself as being a suspense writer. In fact, they're both just coming out. They're being reprinted after all these years in Ellery Queen in January and in February. And then I did the Million Mile Stewardess, Captain Dear, Come Home With Me, you know, the young love stories. And then as I started to have children, I did the home stories. A Place in the Family, When the Bough Breaks, on and on we go. But then the market collapsed. It just collapsed. And that was just at the time I was widowed, so I started writing radio shows. And that was my interest in George, because I did three scripts on him, and I decided he was a fascinating guy. But at least it proved to me that I could write a book. You see, I used to think that being a short story writer was as different from being a novelist as being an eye doctor is different from being an orthopedic surgeon. But George proved I could do a book, and I said, okay, now I want to do something that I might be able to sell. And let's see what I can do. And let's try suspense. Because a good tip is, if you like to read suspense, the odds are that you might have, you know, if you're a writer, you might be able to write it. And it was my vein of gold. I found out that I could write suspense.
Well, tell me about that first suspense novel.
Well, the first one was Where Are the Children? And I thought, okay, I want to write suspense. And something that had always intrigued me was the Lindbergh kidnapping. All you have to do is mention that, and everybody has a theory. Think of all the books that have been written all these years later. I remember my mother and father talking about that case when I was very little. I remember driving past on our way to our summer cottage in Silver Beach. We would pass St. Raymond Cemetery, and my father would always say, and there, my dear, is where the ransom note was left for that poor little baby. So you know how that sticks? And I thought, kidnapping is a good subject. The whole world is a vigilante if there's a missing child. Everybody cares terribly. So I thought, I'm going to go into the kidnapping field. And that became Where Are the Children? I wrote it for 3 years, from 5 till 7 in the morning, because I was working, you see. Then I get the kids up, feed them fast, and race for the carpool into New York. But at least the book was growing. I was doing something. You have that feeling of something is working, something that really might be good. And I go through my diary now saying, I'm stuck, I'll never get finished. And then I see one entry that says, I have finished the book and it is good. That was the whole page with a bunch of exclamation points.
Well, wasn't it hard to write with a writing day as chopped up as it was, 2 hours, and then all the other things you had to do, and then go back the next day, just a little bit?
But this is what I tell anybody who wants to be a writer and says, I'll write as soon as the kids go to school, or until, or when I, or when the kids go to school, or when I retire, or when I get a room with gross ventilation, you know? And I said, no, you don't wait. You make your time to write. There is nobody who can take an hour or two in the day. If you're a morning person, as I am, get up before the rest of the gang. If you're a night person, write an hour or two after everybody else goes to bed. But the thing is, even if you get two pages done, two pages and two pages and two pages, eventually a book doth make.
But you have to, what if you're going strong and all of a sudden you look at the clock and you say, gosh, I have to cut myself off.
Look at Cinderella. You know, she got the prince at the end, glass slipper or no, right? I wrote the 2 hours and that was all I could do. But then, you see, I could be thinking during the day about it. You know, when you're traveling, when you're driving, when you're on buses or whatever, be planning ahead a little bit. So that when I sat down in the morning, I was able to get into it. And sometimes I get so mad at myself if I ever said, no, just today I won't get up. And I'd sleep those extra couple of hours, and then I'd be mad at myself all day because I didn't have that little feeling of, okay, I'm hammering away at it.
That was the first book. How is it now? Do you find larger spaces of time to write?
Oh, yeah, now I'm a full-time writer. I like to write. I still like to start in the morning. around 6 o'clock, because I do wake up early, and the house is quiet, and the whole world is quiet at that time. You don't get the phone ringing, even if you don't answer it. You just don't get that feeling of other going on. And I like to write until about 1 o'clock. 7 hours is a good day.
Well, and still watch. The book is meticulously plotted, and I couldn't find any loose ends at all. You
I
seem to tie up
not.
Everything.
I really tried. Oh, I tried.
This does happen. Sometimes a writer will forget a character and leave him dangling out in left field. So how do you approach it when you have something as complicated? And if, well, it's easy to read. It's not, when I say complicated, I don't mean that it's tough to read, but you have a lot of plot elements in it and a lot of different characters. So when you start to write something like Still Watch, do you plan this very carefully, or are you the kind of spontaneous writer who can do it?
Oh, I have a real game plan. I have an outline, but I only know who my characters are and what they're going to do, what the major points are going to be in the book, and how it will end. I don't have a full outline, as some writers do, of chapter after chapter. I don't do that because I don't really know yet. When I started Still Watch, the young television anchor woman was going to be tall with dark hair. And when I was starting to write the book, I was about 50 pages in, and she was fighting me. She said, no, I have auburn hair, and I'm not very tall, and I look like my father. And that's when it starts being lovely, when the characters take on such flesh of their own that you really feel they're alive, they're moving around themselves. That's the joy of creative writing, I think. And the congressman boyfriend, at one point I had him suggest that to her, can I stay tonight, Pat? And he said to me, no, I'm not doing that. She's 20 years younger than I. What do you think? I'm trying to break up with this girl. I'm not trying to push her into a relationship. I'm trying to stay away. I don't want to start all over again. So that's a lovely feeling when that happens. It's wonderful. And then I do a lot of research, but sometimes I don't know what research I'll need until I'm into the book. I have scenes in this one in Congress, and I went into some good sessions of the Senate.
You know, I was going to ask you
sessions.
About the time you spent in Washington. You must have spent a considerable amount.
Well, I went back and forth, you see, as I knew what I needed. Vice President Humphrey's sister is a great friend of mine, Frances Howard. She's wonderful. I went to embassy parties with her. I was at a party at Avril Harriman's house, and that gave me a good look around, you know, for a very lovely Georgetown house, which I kind of copy for the ambassador's house in this book. I was at somebody else's house in Georgetown, so I got a good feeling of how the Georgetown houses are laid out and decorated and whatever. I went to CNN to get the feeling of a cable network as opposed to a CBS or an NBC or ABC. Should I mention the competition?
I do.
To really get the feel of how they work, you see, where they're taping right at the desk and the bustle that goes on.
Who did you work with at Cable News Network when you visited? Do you remember?
Well, John Keeley is their military. He tapes a military show, and he's a personal friend. So he took me around, you see, and then he read the book in galleys. And bless his heart, he and his wife both did, and he drove from the places that I name in the book, you know, from Chevy Chase to Georgetown, from Alexandria to Georgetown, from McLean. And he said, you've got to open it up a little, Mary. You haven't left him enough time to get over there and get back within this time. Mm-hmm. You've got to allow for the traffic. Another, he said, okay, technically you're right, the way you drove, but Washingtonians wouldn't drive that way. They would take some back roads, you see. So that's the kind of ring of truth that I like to get. I call three senators' offices, to find out the buzzes. You know, for the Senate, they call them bells, but it's really much more like a buzzer for a vote. To say, and it's funny how, you know, how they think they know it, and people were asking each other, how many, what time did they ring, how much before? Because I really wanted it to be good. And I had a nice feeling down in Washington that people in the know down there said, it's fine.
Yeah, I think you captured the atmosphere of Washington, and what little I know about it, going there only as a visitor and working in that area for a while. But I don't mean to nitpick, but one thing that bothered me a little bit was that the Senator Jennings, turned over all of her papers and films and things to... the reporter.
Carefully edited. She had gone, Toby and her assistant had gone through everything that she turned over, everything.
Okay.
And the one thing that...
I just can't imagine her giving her the book of photographs and things. And well, whatever, take that out of the house and all that.
Well, she had gone through, and remember when the girl asked if she can read, when Pat asked if she can read the letter at the end, she said, you went through everything, didn't mm-hmm. you? And they said, yes, we did.
Mm-hmm.
So that it had all been checked thoroughly, and she was going along with the idea that it was absolutely essential to have a warmer personal image for this, if she was going to be appointed woman okay. vice president.
All right, you convinced me. That's why she was stunned
when the note from Billy surfaced, she was absolutely appalled.
What are the chances of a Still Watch being made into a film?
Well, three of them have been bought. Two of them have been made. Children is being made right now. Cry in the Night, I've had a number of authors on, but we haven't accepted one of them yet. And I always write with the idea that this will make a good film. So I expect that I'll probably get some offers on it.
Well, I can see it. I can, as you, your book is the type that I could visualize very easily. It seemed as though it could be easily translated
well,
to
you
film
see,
if they do it right.
Well, where are the children? They just picked it up, and the screenplay is wonderful. And it's my book. That sounds terrible. You know what I mean. They said you wrote this for film, didn't you? And I said, yeah, it always was in mind that this would be filmed. And that I tried to do it with that kind of eye as well as a novelist's eye. So I do expect that it probably will go. You see, what I love in this is the Arthur character where the guy is hiding in the girl's house. Did you enjoy him?
Yes, I did. And one thing that I liked, and I found this true, the other book that I enjoyed, particularly Strangers Watching, the suspense builds. So we know that Arthur is hiding in the room with the television. And the scenes seem to be a little shorter as tensions build because you know something's going to happen and everything moves faster and faster and faster. It was like a heart beating faster.
Well, I wanted to actually have him sleeping under the girl's bed because I have a dust ruffle in my home and it's thick. You know, you could not see through it. And Michael Corder, who's my wonderful editor over in Simon & Schuster, he said, no, Mary, you can put him in the closet. You can't put him under the bed. I said, Michael, he's nuts. I said, it's every woman's secret fear or hope that there is a man under her bed. I said, every woman will get goosebumps if she thinks, if she's lying in bed alone reading this and thinks maybe there's someone under my bed, just touching the spring and with his eyes all wide and glazed. I said, I love it. He said, the closet, Mary.
Do you work, you must work closely with the editor, do you?
Yes, Michael Corder is, of course, he's a wonderful writer on his own, and he's a marvelous editor. It was funny, though, when I turned this book in just about a year ago, I met him the next day at a party, and he said, Mary, the book is wonderful. It's 99.5% there. Well, I floated for 3 days, and then I had a meeting with him in his office.
And he let you know about the other.
He had pages of single-spaced type about what needed being done. I said, Michael, this is 0.5%. But he takes the time, you see, to really make that story become as what he sees it might be there. It's such a better story after he's worked on it.
Well, he's a pro, all right. I was talking to Alice Adams a while back, and when she printed her first, or wrote her first book, the editor was rather hard on her and even changed the title of the book, and Alice said that she didn't know that you were allowed to argue with editors at the time.
Uh-huh. Oh, no, we really debated some of these things, you know. This is why. Why this boy? Because of this. How about this? And some he gave, and some I said, yeah, you're right. Okay, that's fine.
Well, there's a good thing in that, because the editor, especially one of Corder's stature, can take a long look at what you've written without being as personally and directly involved. When you write something, I'm sure you've found this the case, you're so close to it. Sometimes there are errors in it or things that you can't see. You're so close to it and caught up in it.
Oh, yeah. And then there is always sometimes when you think something is just cuter than words, you know, and you really want to leave it in, and somebody else says no, and turns out to be right.
It's said that the most colorful, poetic, and profound passages in a book that the author just loves are inevitably the worst.
Inevitably the worst. Inevitably. They inevitably end up on the cutting room floor. And then you realize 6 months later, you know, when a little objectivity has crept back into your mind that, yes, indeed, that's the way to go. It should have gone.
There's a young man by the name of David Payne who's written this immense book, 735 pages, 1,400 manuscript pages, called Confessions of a Taoist on Wall Street. And it's pretty good. But he just fought tooth and nail and didn't want to make cuts. And so I think the book, his first novel, and he's a young man only in his mid-20s, and so it's quite an ambitious start.
It is indeed.
But if he had allowed the editor to bring that book down to half the size,
it turns people off,
it would have been a better
book. Yeah. I think sometimes a book can seem too formidable when, you know, when you don't know the author, you're just sort of looking around. Sometimes I think too much length. I think we're getting to be, we move faster. You know, we're so used to the change in television where we get so many impressions in a minute. This is what I say when I'm in writing classes, you know, when I'm speaking at seminars, that you've got about a page to hook your reader, maybe one page. That's about all they give you. And I say to people who write beautiful, beautiful description, and I mean really fun, look, you can't go two chapters on how pretty the town is. We don't know at the end of the first chapter whether or not that guy is on his way into town to murder his mother, to meet the girl he's always loved, to blow up the bank. And even though the description is wonderful, we've got to know why he's there. When he's on that bicycle, the first thing you have to do is say something like, the town is lovely and it will never be the same in another hour. You know, hook us, make us say, why not? You know, the bottom line of every writer is you must be a storyteller. The best lines ever written, the ones that draw us close to the fire and make us all go quiet, are once upon a time. And we want to know what happened. And I think a storyteller must tell a story. And my part of the suspense pie is that I write about very nice people whose lives are invaded. My people are not looking for trouble. That's not my part of the mystery field, you see. In this book, in Stillwatch, it's a young anchor woman. She's going to do a documentary on a senator she admires enormously. This woman is about to become the first woman vice president. And the minute she starts that documentary, her life is in danger. And she's going back to that house because her mother and father were a murder-suicide. She's trying to remember. See, that's something else. We all want to remember what happened. We all look back and try to catch the memory of our childhood. The University of Minnesota did a study that said we can actually remember back clearly to age 2. And the best way to recall accurate memory is to recreate the place, the scene. If you could go into a room, the same room your mother and father had when you were 2 years old, you would remember things that happened when you were 2. And I thought, what a lovely idea. This girl can recreate the room where she stumbled over those bodies. And what will come to her then? And I thought, that's a great idea, because we all have that what happened in us, don't you think?
Mary Higgins Clark, you have us hooked. If people aren't reading it now, it's on the bestseller list, isn't it?
Yeah, it really feels good, because I'm in some fast company out there.
Yeah, well, if they haven't read it by now, they will be. And then I know it'll be a paperback. They'll have a second chance to read it.
Yes, that's right.
And probably a third chance when it's made to a movie, and a fourth chance when it's on television. So thank you very much for coming in, sharing your ideas about the craft of writing and about yourself and your beginnings as a writer. I thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
It's been great being here.
Good.